be seated.
In the second case this morning, Matthew Murphy versus Columbus McKinnon Corporation, 20 AP 1124. Appearances. All right, and were you previously admitted, or do you need to be admitted today? Okay, very good. Welcome. Good morning, all. The lineup that I have is 25 minutes for Mr. English, 20 minutes for counsel, 10 minutes, and then followed up with 5 minutes. Is that your understanding? Okay, very good. Let's proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Kevin English from the Phillips Lytle firm in Buffalo, New York, and I represent the petitioner, Columbus McKinnon. Columbus McKinnon is a Buffalo-based company that designs and manufactures lifting devices such as hoist, winches, hooks, and the lifting tongs at issue in this case. The case presents issues concerning the application of Wisconsin's Omnibus Tort Reform Act. Before I address the law, I know the court is fully familiar with the facts, but there are a few that I think bear emphasis. First, the Dixie tongs at issue are a product with a 130-year history. There have been no reported injury or property damage claims related to the tongs. Second, Wisconsin Power and Light had been using the Dixie tongs for tens of years prior to the date of the accident on May 14, 2013, lifting thousands of poles without injury or property damage. The only time a pole in the record, the only time a pole fell out of the tongs in the field was circumstances, the only time poles fell out of the tongs was in the field, and this occurred with both Dixie tongs and jaw-style tongs when the tongs were not put on the pole directly. The witnesses for Wisconsin Power and Light testified unequivocally to that fact. There is no contrary evidence in this record. Next, on May 14th, day of the accident, plaintiff controlled the entire operation. He chose the tongs to move the pole. He chose to use a remote device to use the pole. He attached the tongs, it's undisputed, he attached the tongs 7 inches from the pole's balance point. And it's undisputed that he lifted the pole over his head 15 feet in the air.
What responsibility does your client have, counselor, for people who don't put the tongs on the pole exactly where it would be best for them to put it?
Well, Your Honor, our responsibility is to warn. And in this instance, we warned. It's undisputed.
I didn't think there was any warning that had followed along with these tongs that were used.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I didn't think there was any warning that was attached to the tongs that were used.
There was no, well, when the tongs were sold, on the day they were sold, there was a warning attached. There were actually two warnings attached. One was an attached warning. The other was a sticker that went on both arms of the tongs.
Was the sticker still there on the date of injury?
No, it wasn't. And in fact, Your Honor, our position is that was a change in the product. So the warning was off the tongs, and that was a change in the product.
After it left the hands of the manufacturer. Was it a sticker? Was it just a sticker that was on the arms of the prongs? Is that what it was?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. It was a sticker.
Okay. And have you done any kind of investigation about how long those stickers tend to stay?
Well, Your Honor, that was not an issue in the case. because what happened was the plaintiff's expert initially said that there was a failure to warn. When I took his deposition, he acknowledged that the warnings were perfectly fine. He did say, well, maybe the warnings could have come off. And when I asked him if there was a reasonable alternative to keeping a warning on the tongs, he said, no, there wasn't. Based on that, on our motion for summary judgment, the plaintiff did not pursue that claim.
Okay.
And that was not a claim pursued at the Court of Appeals.
So there's no failure to warn in this case.
There is no failure to warn in this case, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Going back to the facts that I would just further like to emphasize, the plaintiff's expert did no testing of the Dixie tongs, and the plaintiff's expert did no testing of the jaw-style tongs that he opined were an alternative design. Except for providing three photographs of the jaw-style tongs, there is no evidence in the record concerning the specifications of the tongs. There's no evidence of their safety history. There's no evidence of their reliability.
Counsel, it's not clear to me if your argument thus far is on strict liability or if it is also embracing the negligence of the plaintiff. It sounds like it's addressing the negligence of the plaintiff also. Am I hearing you correctly, or what?
No, Your Honor. Those factors come into play when you are doing the analysis required by the risk utility test under the statute. Those factors come into play. The facts that I just explained.
The ordinary negligence claim. Whether or not the plaintiff acted reasonably are factors under, are you saying under the statute? Let me be more specific. Are those factors under Restatement Third?
The plaintiff's conduct. There are factors set forth. But those factors are not the only factors. The guidance that's provided by the Restatement of Third is not exclusive, and they expressly noted it's not exclusive and it's not exhaustive. So I believe that this court can take into account the conduct of the plaintiff, because under the risk utility test, it's no longer a liability without fault standard. There is a fault standard to be considered.
Well, how are you picking that up rather than the consumer contemplation standard, which is what we've used for years?
That is where I'm picking it up, is in the consumer contemplation standard, because again, if you consider consumer contemplation here is a little bit of a misnomer, right? Because we're not talking about an ordinary consumer here. We're talking about even plaintiff's expert identified the fact that this is a product that is not used by the ordinary consumer. This is a product that's used by utilities, by companies in both the commercial lighting industry or commercial power industry and the commercial logging industry. So we're not talking about those types of individuals, but I do think that's the place where it picks it up, Your Honor.
Counsel, I highlighted in my question comments regarding plaintiff's negligence and the reasonableness of plaintiff's actions, because of import to me is that this is, as I recall, summary judgment.
It was, Your Honor.
Yes. And generally, issues of negligence, issues of reasonableness of a plaintiff's conduct are questions for the jury.
I don't disagree with that. but there are extreme cases where the conduct of the plaintiff can be considered. But I don't think in this case, even if you take the negligence piece and put it to the side, the plaintiff has still failed to meet its burden under the Act to demonstrate that there was a design defect. You can set the plaintiff's negligence aside. There's still no showing under the statute. Under the statute...
Well, isn't that... You have competing experts, as I recall, in this case. There is a lingering Daubert question in this case. You have competing experts. Again, summary judgment with competing experts often is left to the jury as opposed to a court determining as a matter of law.
Your Honor, that would be true if the competing experts provided evidence that satisfied the statute. But the plaintiff's expert did not do that.
I know your argument with regard to that. Just one final question that's a bit separate. Is it your position the language of the statute is clear and unambiguous?
I believe there's some ambiguity between the 1A and 1B. The statute reverses, uses not reasonably safe and unreasonable. Does that provide ambiguity? It's possible. I think that's for this. I think it's for this court to determine. But I don't think it affects the determination in this case, because even if you determine that Section 1B requires a demonstration of unreasonably dangerous, that's an added element to the claim.
Well, it makes a difference to me what your argument is as to ambiguity. You said it's for us to decide. Well, you're right. We will decide it. But I want to know what your position is. Is the statute ambiguous or unambiguous?
I think it's ambiguous, and the court needs to look to two places to determine whether or not there's to resolve the ambiguity. In the first, the two places it should look are the circumstances surrounding the adoption and the language of the statute itself. If you look at the circumstances surrounding the adoption of the statute, of course, comes in the shadow of this court's concurring and dissenting opinions in Horst and Godoy.
So you're looking at the legislative history to inform how we should interpret the language of the statute.
I'm actually looking at this court's, not necessarily the legislative history. The legislative history does not specifically speak to Horst and Godoy.
It doesn't specifically speak to what?
Horst and Godoy, the two decisions of this court that predated the legislature's adoption of the statute. But I would note that just
the legislative history, at least the language of the legislation, I think it's set forth in paragraph 29 of the Court of Appeals opinion, that is the legislative findings and intent regarding this product liability law. The legislature's findings and intent stated as follows. It is in the public interest to clarify product liability law generally and the application of the risk contribution theory of liability first announced by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in Collins, that's the DES case I say parenthetically, specifically in order to return tort law to its historical common law roots. End of quote. So it seems to me, how do you deal with that bit of
Well, Your Honor, the if you look at the legislative history, what it states under strict liability is this bill establishes the criteria to determine if a product manufacturer, distributor, or seller is liable to a person injured by the manufactured product based on a claim of strict liability. So the legislative intent specifically says it is setting forth the criteria to determine. That was the intent of the statute. And the statute, again, as I mentioned, comes in the shadow of Horst and Godoy. And Justice Ziegler noted in the Seifert case that legislature's adoption of the Omnibus Tort Reform Act appeared to be part of a legislative reaction to the decisions of this court. If you then go to the statute itself, the first section of the statute is verbatim from the Restatement Third. And that's a risk utility test.
That's not what it's called in the first paragraph, paragraph A. Also, the statute we're talking about, 895.047,
yes.
Says that it doesn't apply to negligence. So
yes.
Negligence claims are outside of the statute, correct?
I don't disagree with that concept, Your Honor, but in this case...
Well, that's what the statute says. I don't know if it's a concept. I think it's...
I would agree, but I'm not arguing that for all purposes... negligence doesn't have, there isn't a separate negligence claim. Mm-hmm. However, in this case, at oral argument on the motion, counsel represented to the court that his negligence claim was, the facts and the expert opinion of his negligence claim were the same. So, and I can actually...
Well, I can understand. He would complain about the same facts and say they give rise to a claim in negligence. We see that all the time. You have alternate pleading based on one set of facts. I don't find that unusual.
If I might, Your Honor, just at page 157, the question was asked, does your negligence claim rely on anything other than the argument that supports your strict liability claim, that being that the defendant corporation could have made these tongs safer than they did and chose not to, and that was the basis of their negligence. And counsel answered, correct. Yeah, it's the same proof. It's going to be our engineer's testimony that, you know, the design defects to this are unreasonably dangerous as to the negligence theory. In this case, they are identical claims.
Well, that's fine. I mean, we have cases here all the time where the facts are identical, but there are two claims that are made from them. The necessity of proving the elements of the claims falls together a little bit differently, but the facts are the same. I don't think that that's unusual.
I don't think it is either, Your Honor.
Okay.
So can you just help us out here? Name the claims. Name how you think the law, what the law is on those claims. And just to make sure I understand your position.
Sure. Our position is there are two claims remaining in the case. There were other claims in the case, but remaining in the case are two claims. A strict liability claim. What's the standard? Under the Wisconsin Omnibus Tort Act, you're talking about 0471A, it first requires a demonstration of a reasonable alternative design. Mm-hmm. Second, because it's and, it requires a demonstration that the omission of the alternative design renders the product not reasonably safe. Then, under 1B, there is the question of the plaintiff has to prove that the product was unreasonably dangerous. Those are the elements that are at issue in this case.
And what's the standard under the negligence claim?
The standard under the negligence claim is the normal standards you have: duty, breach, causation, damages.
Is there an argument here? Let's assume for the minute that, I think the Court of Appeals looked and said, oh, we think there's competing experts here. Justice Ann Bradley was referencing that in the record, too. Do you have another argument if that one doesn't work on summary judgment? I mean, do you focus on the unreasonably dangerous component under 1B, or are you putting all of your eggs in the fact that on summary judgment that the reasonable alternative design is not, you know, evident from the materials?
I have two arguments. The first would be as to Section 1A and its two requirements. Plaintiff's expert may have indicated, or I would say indicated, as opposed to demonstrated, based on his analysis, may have demonstrated that the alternative design could have been safer, or was safer, in two aspects: two teeth and clamping force. But there is no evidence, and he did not opine, that just because there are more teeth on the jaw-style design and it has greater clamping force, those facts alone render the Dixie tongs not reasonably safe. That would be my first analysis. My second analysis, Your Honors, would be this. Under Section 1B, I just want, if I can get to my notes. Under the consumer expectation test, it adopts an additional element, as I noted. In Vincer versus Esther Williams, this court held that if the average consumer would reasonably anticipate the dangerous condition of the product and fully appreciate the attendant risk of injury, it would not be unreasonably dangerous and defective. I'd further note that in Vincer, this court relied significantly on its decision in Arbit versus Gunderson. There, this court noted the difference between a plaintiff suing a manufacturer of a station wagon with a hidden defect and a plaintiff suing the manufacturer of a Volkswagen complaining that the car was too small to be safe. In Sumlich versus Toyota, this court again, looking at Arbit, noted that for a defective condition to be unreasonably dangerous, it must be hidden, not obvious. Here, there's nothing hidden about the alleged design defect of the Dixie tongs. In fact, it's undisputed in this case that both types of the tongs were on the truck and were available to the plaintiff on the day of accident. He had experience using both types of the tongs. He knew their relative differences, and he chose to use the Dixie tongs. It's also undisputed that the plaintiff knew the dangers of using the tongs in general and the specific danger of using the tongs when they were not properly attached to a pole. Undisputed evidence. So that would be the second piece, Your Honor.
Can I just summarize and make sure I understand your argument?
Yes.
The legislature in Act 2 adopted the reasonable alternative design from Restatement 3rd with regard to the proper focus of the test, moved away from the consumer contemplation test in terms of what the design looks like.
That's right.
But we still have, and so the two prongs of that are the alternative design and that omission's not reasonably safe. You think there's no evidence that it's not reasonably safe, even if there is a reasonable alternative design, which you also would make an argument on that point, too.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then under 1B, we still have the common law consumer expectations test in determining whether it's unreasonably dangerous.
Yes.
And that has not been satisfied here by the evidence in the record.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
I do want to spend, if there are no further questions on that issue, I want to spend a few moments on the fact that as part of the Omnibus Tort Reform Act, the legislature amended Section 907 and adopted the Daubert standard for determining the reliability of expert opinion.
Counsel, I'm sorry, before you move on, I'm a little puzzled by your response to Justice Hagedorn, because in your briefing, did you not argue that the legislature eliminated the consumer contemplation or expectations test? Are you backing off of that argument now?
What we were arguing, Your Honor, was really the Court of Appeals focus or lack of focus on the first two prongs under 1A. And if you look at the Court of Appeals opinion, what it did was it characterized Section 895 as reflecting a supplement to the consumer contemplation test formerly adhered to under the common law. And then in its application was looking more at the consumer contemplation test instead of the risk utility test. And there is no question, based on the statute, that the first two elements of a design defect case must satisfy the risk utility test. And then our position is, if 1B kept the unreasonably dangerous standard under the common law, you have to adopt all of the common law there, which requires that it be a hidden danger, not an open and obvious danger. That is our position. I see my red light is on, so I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Matthew Murphy was a lineman for Wisconsin Power and Light. And on this particular day, they were taking old power poles out of the ground and replacing them. The particular power pole in question had already been removed from the ground and was laying flat. Matthew Murphy was trained on how to lift these poles. The concept is you don't want to be in the exact center point, because then if the pole tilts one direction or the other, you either have to push down or you have to lift up on the pole to right it. So they purposely make it that the end they're going to be on is the lighter end. It's just a little bit over, so then that way the end that they're going to be on to guide is going to be pushing up, and they just push down just enough. In this case, it required 16 pounds of force to keep this pole level. The safety manager for WP&L testified that this is the way they train them to do it. Matthew Murphy was trained this way, his coworkers, and the engineer for Columbus McKinnon conceded he knows this is how they do it out in the field. They lift these poles and they put their hands on them to right them, which is what occurred in this case. Matthew Murphy had one hand on the pole and he had his other hand on a remote control on his waist, and he's lifting this pole, which has to go into a bin that's about 5 feet tall. So he has to lift it to get over into the bin. So at some point, this pole starts to tilt, and he's attempting to right the pole when it falls and lands on his head. And he ended up with these injuries that we have here today. Our contention is that this is an unreasonably dangerous product in that it does not have a mechanical advantage for the clamping forces to keep it into the pole. Additionally, there's only 2 points of contact, one on each side.
Does the utility company that he works for have the other type of clamp, too, for poles?
They did, and that was also on the truck, and he selected this one to use on that day.
Okay. And was he the foreman for the job that would decide how a job was put together?
No, he was, the lowest level worker.
Right, right. So he was doing whatever was requested. Well, here it was to lift this pole and get it on the truck. Okay. How much experience did he have with lifting poles?
I believe he was about 6 to 8 years in on this job and
okay.
Countless poles.
So he's done it before?
He had.
Did he personally select the tongs, or did somebody else select the tongs?
We believe he personally selected the tongs. Mr. Murphy does not remember any of these events because he had a large section of his skull removed.
Yeah, right. He got a bad injury. That's right.
Counsel,
which, of course,
he can't sue
his employer, so we are looking to someone else to sue. Correct?
That's how we do it.
Counsel, I want to make sure we get the law right on this. I understand the application matters a lot, too. But do you agree with your opposing counsel that the legislature, under 1A, by copying that language identically from the restatement third, adopted the reasonable alternative design framework from the restatement third?
I think that they adopted that language. But I don't think that there's any indication that they thought the risk utility analysis needed to be performed here. They didn't reference the comment, and they didn't include that language in the statute, which some other states have done. In a question earlier was, is this ambiguous? I don't think so. So I don't think 1A is ambiguous. I think the question here for the jury that they've added on is, you've got to have a reasonable alternative design, and then the jury has to decide, does that design make a difference? Is it unsafe if you don't have that reasonable alternative design? So I think that's the jury question that needs to be answered. So I don't think the jury, and obviously this court will decide that question of what the jury instruction would say, but I think the jury instruction would ask them to essentially perform that task that's in the statute. It should mirror the statute.
So what exactly do you think the legislature was doing by using that language? Because it did copy it verbatim from the restatement third. What change do you think that affected? Again, just focusing on the law here for a minute.
That the plaintiff has to bring forth a reasonable alternative design. That was never required
okay.
before.
So you agree that the reasonable alternative design was adopted. But the statute says that, I guess. But.
Okay. Correct. I think that's what they were doing.
Yes. Okay. And then, so I don't see a huge disagreement necessarily in the legal framework. Maybe, I guess, he argues you look to some of the comments you're opposing counsel, and maybe you don't. But in terms of the broad legal framework, are you generally in agreement with it? You just think you've got enough here to go to the jury. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, we do not think that you do a risk-utility analysis based on the unambiguous nature of the statute. But you do have to show an alternative design, and the jury's going to have to decide whether it would be not safe if you didn't have that.
Make your best argument that the based on what you have submitted, the summary judgment materials you've submitted, that this is not reasonably safe. And then also make your best argument based upon the 1B framework that this is unreasonably dangerous. What specifically do you think demonstrates that? Because a better design doesn't necessarily make something not reasonably safe or unreasonably dangerous.
Well, in this case, I believe we've shown that the alternative design would have prevented this injury. So John DeRosa went out and he examined the pole, examined the place where these Dixie tongs were attached. He calculated the weight of the pole based on measurements at about 580 pounds. He calculated the forces that the Dixie pole tongs would push in to clamp and determined that the alternative design had four times the clamping force inward, and he already knew the weight of the log at that point. He also determined that, look, you've got two points of attachment with the Dixie pole tongs, so if one of them fails, that's it. It's going to drop.
Let me just probe that a little further. I mean, I'm no expert in manufacturing designs, but it strikes me that it's very likely that you could come up with, for example, some design that might make something incrementally safer and prevent an injury. But that isn't necessarily the test. So even if you're right that the design that's being suggested here would have presented this injury, that isn't the question, I think, statutorily. The question is whether it's not reasonably safe or, under 1B, unreasonably dangerous, which strikes me as something quite a bit different. You could have something that's safe, and then you could still define something that's safer. And just because you could design something that's safer doesn't mean the safe thing is unreasonably dangerous, right? Logically, I guess. So help me out. Why is this unreasonably dangerous?
Is that logic?
Well, if you have a safe thing, what I'm saying is if you have a safe thing that can be designed more safely, the safe thing isn't dangerous. And so just because you can have a better designed pole that prevents an injury doesn't mean what you have meets the statutory requirement, which is not that something can be safer, that it's unreasonably dangerous, or under 1A, that's not reasonably safe.
Well, but I think the argument you just made is something safe and then you could make it safer. Well, then the first thing wasn't safe. There was a risk. There was a danger that you designed out with your alternative design. And then the question is, was it significant enough that it's unsafe without it? And I think that's the jury question here, is do we go there? The other thing that, you know, John DeRosa testified that there would be four points of contact with this size log, so that you've got a redundancy there. So if one of them slips, then you still have three left, you know, opposing side still pushing there. And the last thing is, when you close the Hog Davis alternative design, at the bottom, when they're completely closed, that is smaller than the size of the log. So there was actually a third mechanism to hopefully prevent this injury or provide additional time, at least, for Mr. Murphy to realize these things are slipping and I can get out of the way. So from our perspective, we believe that there was an added hurdle to this case with the product liability law, but we still maintained the consumer contemplation test when we get back to, was it unreasonably dangerous? So they have to mean something different, 1A or B. Otherwise, they're asking you to do the same thing with different language. So if you're going to give meaning to 1A, it has to be something different than 1B. I think that's where we get in. Now, you know, a lot of states have actually, some states have made it so you can pick as a plaintiff. You can pick, you're going to go with consumer contemplation or you're going to go with a risk utility analysis. Other states have required both. That's the defense proposal here, that they would like you to infer that we have this risk utility test, that we're going to have a multifactorial analysis Now, if you look at that test, what the Court of Appeals did, they did apply that test, and one of the things is the consumer's expectations. So that's the consumer contemplation. It's just one of the things you can consider. The list, you know, isn't exhaustive, but certainly I think that our proof here, and the Court of Appeals agreed, gets over the standard, meets the standard, you know, and the jury's going to have to make that determination on, you know, was Matthew Murphy negligent? And then is there, where would the comparison go from there?
Judge Sykes, in the separate writing in Green, says this, and I want to know if you agree with this. The third restatement makes clear consumer expectations are relevant but not dispositive in the determination of whether a product design is defective and unreasonably dangerous. Do you agree, if you're able to answer, do you agree with that? Or
yeah, I agree that if you're gonna use the risk utility analysis, that it's just a factor, it's not dispositive. Otherwise, it would be the same thing. You'd have the same test twice in a row, so there has to be some meaning to it.
Would you respond to your opposing counsel's argument that under the 1B scenario, just looking at some of the common law, looking at some of our cases and whether something is unreasonably dangerous. Maybe you've done, feel like you've done that, but I'm going to give you another opportunity to address that point head on, because if you lose on that point, you lose on the whole claim.
Well,
potential.
You know, the question, one thing was open and obvious. In the Shu versus Fox River Tractor case, 63 Wis. 2nd, 728, the court held that open and obvious is a question for the jury and does not defeat a product liability claim. So, again, it's a negligence comparison claim. And so in this case, we have testimony that this is an unreasonably dangerous product because it doesn't have sufficient clamping force. It doesn't have a redundancy. What happened here is exactly the risk. We've got testimony that the foreman on this job did say that, in fact, he's familiar with both tongs, and that these Dixie pull tongs have a much higher failure rate than the Hog Davis alternative design. So that is evidence that they are unreasonably dangerous, and the jury has to decide, just as you were raising, how much safer does it need to be in order to for this to be unreasonably dangerous. So I do think that's a jury question.
Counsel, opposing counsel said that there was no failure to warn claim before us. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true, because the sticker had long since worn off.
Just because it's worn off, does that excuse the manufacturer?
Well, I think it does not, but I don't have engineering testimony, you know, that this warning wasn't sufficient if they had designed it so that it would stay. So I don't get over the hurdle on that.
Okay, so you agree with his characterization?
Yeah, that there's not a failure to warn claim.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel represents that there have not been injuries, that this is kind of a new thing, both at this company and maybe in general for these. How would you factor that into the analysis of whether this is dangerous, either not reasonably safe or unreasonably dangerous?
Well, I mean, I think that Justice Rogensack probably raised the real reason there is people claim workers' compensation and they don't bring a product liability claim. So Columbus McKinnon doesn't know that they're injured, but, you know, I'm...
Other than this injury, is there anything in the record to suggest that these have ever hurt anyone else?
You know, no, we did not, you know, try to track down other folks who were injured when poles dropped. So I don't have that in the record.
You mentioned that a foreman said that the Dixie tongs slipped more than the other variety. So is that in the record?
It is in the record, and we've cited it in our brief.
All right. So that is something that shows that there have been problems in the past.
Correct. I see my time is up, so
it's not up yet.
Oh,
until
okay.
It's red. Keep going.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, and in fact, I did cite to the case that said that the lack of prior accidents was not definitive because in this case, with strict liability, the person who is marketing the product is in a better position to absorb this risk and fix this problem than the consumer or the worker. That's the Ransom v. Wisconsin Electric Power case. Also, I would note that the defense focuses on Mr. Murphy's conduct. Specifically, they argue that he was underneath the pole, but when I asked their expert, can you say he was under the pole or was he to the side of the pole? And he said, I can't answer that. I don't know. And based on the testimony and his reconstruction, plaintiff's expert concluded that Mr. Murphy was actually to the side of the pole and attempting to guide the pole when the pole fell. You know, the one thing is, as you're moving the pole towards the bin with the remote control and you see it's out of control, if you stop, there's momentum and the pole will continue to swing towards the bin and then it will continue to swing back towards the operator. So we don't know Mr. Murphy's exact position, but the defense has the burden to prove contributory negligence and they cannot prove that he was underneath this pole.
But there were two kinds of tongs in the truck, the jaw type and the Dixie tongs, right?
There were.
All right. And your theory is that the Dixie tongs shouldn't have been, I mean, part of your theory is they shouldn't have been in the truck at all. He should have been forced to use the jaw type tongs, right?
Right. And they're not in the trucks now.
So when you go to trial and you have all the potential actors on the verdict form, the employer's going to be on the verdict form.
They will.
So how's that? Well, never mind. I'm just looking ahead.
Well, we, you
trial
don't do
judge days. You know, how's that look when your defense is really that the employer shouldn't have had those in the truck?
Well, for instance, if the jury were to conclude that the employer was 20% at fault and Columbus McKinnon was 80%, then under strict liability law in the division, they would actually have 100%. On the other hand,
they once sold the tongs to the employer.
Right, but if they were only 50% on the employer and 50% on Columbus McKinnon, then we would only recover half of our damages. So there will be a comparison. The other thing I wanted to point out is, look, if I have two options, I've got a lawnmower without guards and then a lawnmower with guards, that's not a defense to the person who made that lawnmower without guards. It's still a defective product, and that's the way with all defective products. You make it available out there to the consumer, and it's not as safe as an alternative design, then that's what this statute contemplates.
Well, it may or may not be a defective product, but it may get you to a jury.
It would get me to a jury, correct.
Like a no-mow in reverse option, for example.
I'm sorry.
The Horst case.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Could you explain what you'd like us to do with the negligence claim?
Well, I mean, I think that the negligence claim is a separate question for the jury. For instance, and there might be some claims where it's different. For instance, I had a case where there was a doggy bed where you would microwave this gel, big gel packet, and you would put it in there. May I finish my answer?
Yes, you may finish.
Thank you. And you would put it in the bed, and it would keep it warm for the dog overnight. But what was never contemplated is that people like my client would have their animal in the barn. So they're carrying this gel thing outside to the barn, and when you get that change in temperature from hot to really cold in Wisconsin in winter, the thing explodes on people and causes severe burns. There were about 100 people injured in the country with that. Well, we didn't have an alternative design, but we're saying it's negligent to have a product that's going to explode in your face when you carry it outside to put it in your barn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Thank you for allowing me to appear today on behalf of Wisconsin Association for Justice, its members, and their clients. WAJ's primary concern in this case is law development, and specifically what it views as the Court of Appeals' overly complicated analysis of 895.047.1A, and also within 1B, the application of the consumer contemplation standard, which I'm not sure we have any disagreement anymore over. So I'll focus primarily on sub 1A. Instead of applying sub 1A's plain and unambiguous language, the Court of Appeals departed from that and inserted restatement commentary that was not adopted by the legislature, which will lead to great uncertainty, unpredictability, and over-litigation of future products liability cases, and we ask the court to simplify that. I know the court, we've had some discussion here about the risk-utility factors. I want to point out the distinction there. Those come from comment F of Restatement 3rd, Section 2. The language that the legislature borrowed, and they didn't borrow it verbatim, actually, is from the restatement proper. But the legislature did not include those balancing factors anywhere within the statutes or reference them. And we know that the legislature did not intend to have this court, as unfortunately the Court of Appeals did, apply those balancing factors for two reasons. So one is this court's longstanding precedent that absent special definition from the legislature, this court applies the plain, unambiguous text of the statute. So what that restatement comment goes to, that restatement comment F, is to help put some definition on the phrase not reasonably safe. However, that phrase is unambiguous. There is no ambiguity about what it means to be not reasonably safe. Juries in Wisconsin in negligence cases, we heard a criminal case before this, and in a wide variety of other contexts, look at those words, not reasonably safe, and determine that without any special definition.
Let me just ask a quick question about that. You know, the same act, the court adopted the Daubert standards, right? But it didn't say it was adopting Daubert.
Yep.
It didn't reference any of the case law. It didn't do anything like that. All it did is copy the federal statute in which there's a body of law that's associated with it. This court understood that to be, well, all courts have understood that to be, legal community understood it to be an incorporation of that. So when the legislature, you know, the language that is, here's the big picture test, right, and you have a restatement which has explanations of the test, and it comes a year and a half after this court, in a couple of separate opinions, was explicitly adopting or advocating the adoption of that test. Why wouldn't you incorporate the broader framework?
A couple of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, it's the legislature's knowledge going into writing the statute. So with respect to Daubert, the legislature knew before it enacted the revised, I believe it's 90702, knew that this court's prior precedent is where the court or the legislature adopts a federal procedural rule, that the federal body of authority that comes along with that procedural rule is persuasive authority. We have no such rule for restatement commentary or treatise commentary of any kind, and it would create an unworkable problem, and I can get into that. I would also point out that the legislature adopted 895.047. The case law that Your Honor points to are dissents and concurrences, not the majority opinion. The majority opinion before the legislature adopted 895.047.2 was always, we reject the risk utility factors and we have the consumer contemplation test. That was the body of authority going in. Now,
and in some ways, that maybe is the persuasive point. In full disclosure, I happen to have been around at the time for this. This was adopted, again, about a year and a half after you had four justices of the court openly calling for the adoption of this test from the restatement third, and then you have the legislature basically word for word putting that in the bill.
Well, let me describe a counterargument for a moment.
Sure, please.
Okay. So if we look at the restatement comments themselves, we can tell that the legislature did not intend to impose this risk utility balancing test for a number of reasons. So we can tell that the legislature adopted some of the suggestions from the restatement commentary, but not others. For example, 895.047 sub 1B retains, we've talked about it, the unreasonably dangerous consumer contemplation standard within the statute. That is one of the risk utility balancing factors that's discussed in the comments. Nowhere in the legislation are the others mentioned, and that risk utility balancing, nothing in the restatement third talks about that standard except for the comments. If we look at subsections 1A and 3, they discuss warnings, product misuse, inherent characteristics of the product, standards and regulations, how to deal with those. That all comes from the comments. Some of the comments were applied. Some of them were not. Even the language of 1A is not a wholesale adoption of the restatement third. It treats sellers and distributors drastically different than the restatement third does. And we also know that the legislature rejected some of the commentary. For example, we've talked about this as well. Negligence claims under the legislature's version survive. In some of the commentary, it suggests that negligence and strict products liability cases emerge. That's a difference. Another difference is, for example, comment D to the restatements talks about scenarios where the plaintiff shouldn't have to provide a reasonable alternative design. We know the legislature rejected that also because the legislature requires that now as a part of the plaintiff's burden of proof in every case. I think what I focus on is the consequence of adopting these restatement comments that the legislature chose not to put in. So they certainly could have. I looked at North Carolina statute 99B6. It has a very similar test based on the restatement third, but it specifically lists those risk utility factors right in the statute and describes the standard with which a jury or judge is to apply them. The restatement comments, this risk utility balancing factors, are sort of a mess. Counsel admitted they're non-exhaustive. There's non-exclusive. Sometimes they're internally contradictory. The restatements discuss scenarios where, well, this one might apply and this one may not. The restatements also discuss scenarios where none of them may apply. And the restatements discuss the split amongst jurisdictions as to how to apply them, including jurisdictions applying different burdens of proof. Some jurisdictions say it's the plaintiff's burden of proof. Some jurisdictions say it's the defense. The legislature chose not to incorporate that. Now, I don't want to take away any argument from any party. Reasonableness is an argument that this court has said goes to the jury. It's wide open, just like in every other negligence case. Certainly, either the plaintiff or the defense can use the suggestions from the restatement to argue that. But what we don't want is to incorporate silently all of this restatement commentary. I mean, there's 11,000 words of restatement commentary associated with this particular restatement, and I think that will create a mess for circuit courts and litigants going forward. I mean, in every products liability case going forward now, you will have the defense, if we follow the Court of Appeals decision, coming to the circuit court judge and saying, well, this sentence in the commentary really supports my position. I want you to do a jury instruction on that, whether the legislature intended to incorporate it or not. The legislature's solution is better. Predictability is better. This court has talked about the importance of predictability as a major factor in stare decisis, and we fear that this is going to become one of those areas where we're sort of, it has the appearance of creating ad hoc law each and every case. And, you know, imagine the nightmare for circuit court judges and litigants to get to the summary judgment stage, or worse, get through the evidence into the jury instruction conference and have ambiguity about what is the legal standard and how to apply it.
So 1B, you say there seems to now today be agreement on what that means and how it applies, right?
Yes.
So the difference lies in 1A?
I think there's two separate arguments there, Your Honor. 1A, we're talking about our position is we should simply apply the plain language of the statute. Require foreseeability, a reasonable alternative design, and allow the jury to decide what is not reasonably safe and what is not. If the legislature wanted another test to be incorporated to define those terms, it could do so tomorrow. But please don't depart from this court's longstanding precedent that undefined words.
And how are they not using the language of the statute?
Well, the main argument that WAJ is concerned about here is Columbus McKinnon's argument that those restatement comments, and frankly the Court of Appeals decision that incorporates those restatement comments silently into the language of the statute. We ask this court to simplify that analysis, and sub 1A means what it says. Juries can decide that based on its plain language. And we've had a jury instruction now in effect with no appeals, no issues for 10 years, 3260.1, that does exactly that. It just lists the elements based on the plain language of the statute. It doesn't talk about the restatement commentary or the additional risk utility factors that the legislature did not incorporate. Now, if we go down to sub 1B and we talk about the consumer contemplation standard, I agree, I think, with both counsel here that now the former consumer contemplation test is incorporated into the plaintiff's burden of proof, but as a separate and additional element. You know, this court said in Meyer versus Champs that if the statute tracks the language of the case law, the statute is not one in derogation of the common law, but indeed is one that attempted to codify the common law. Sub B is different from the restatement third. It comes from our prior common law. We ask that the court retain the common law, but now as an element, not to overcome sub A, but as an ongoing element of the plaintiff's burden of proof. And I see my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. English.
Just a few points, Your Honors. I actually don't think there is a significant dispute here in the sense of what are the elements the court needs to apply. It is, under 1A, a two-prong test. Is there an alternative reasonable design? And, as a separate prong, does the absence of that alternative design render the product not reasonably safe?
And you get that from the plain meaning of 1A, right?
That's right. I get that from 1A. Mm-hmm. With respect to the comments from the restatement, this court has long looked at comments to the restatement to interpret or provide guidance. I don't want to say the word interpret. This isn't an interpretation. We don't think there are any more elements. It is guidance for looking at what those elements consist of.
Counsel, you just said it was,
Please go ahead.
Well, I'm confused, and I may be confused for the same reason Justice Anwash Bradley is. You started off saying that the statute was ambiguous. Now you've just said it's unambiguous, but we still need the comments from the restatement.
I'm talking about the elements. My ambiguity really is 1A says not reasonably safe. 1B says unreasonably dangerous, right? If you're looking at so those are two ambiguous. If you read them together, there's ambiguity. There's ambiguity there. And so now, if you're now looking to determine the difference between not reasonably safe and unreasonably dangerous, that's where I'm saying go to the comments of the restatement to get guidance as to the ambiguity. And again, for example, with respect to the Tort Reform Act, the court did adopt a new expert standard. This court went to the federal rules of evidence and the comments to the federal rules of evidence to determine, to seek guidance for what was meant by the adoption of the Daubert standard.
Counsel, I'll tell you what I think is unreasonably dangerous. For me, what is unreasonably dangerous is adopting carte blanche comments to restatements or giving them without explicitly stating either in our opinions or in the statute now. That's what we're dealing with is a statute, not the development of common law, the statute, giving them carte blanche acceptance. We are careful when we approach restatements. Sometimes we cite them with approval. Sometimes we adopt them. And when we're writing opinions, we always have to make sure, what have we done in the past? Have we cited it with approval or we have not? What have we done with regard to the comments? Have we adopted comments or have we not? And so there are 18 comments. There are 18 comments, and as your opposing counsel says, with over 11,000 words, I think that is unreasonably dangerous to give weight to those comments unless the legislature has explicitly indicated weight someplace. Just tell us. Tell us, then we'll do it. But
Your Honor, with respect to this case, there's only one comment in issue.
Only one comment.
It's comment F. That's the only comment. That's the only comment we're talking about.
Has the legislature said we should adopt comment or that it intended that comment F be adopted?
No, but as counsel pointed out, Your Honor, where the legislature didn't want something where the legislature didn't want guidance, they said it in the statute. They said. It's, by the way, the for example, the negligence. I see my time is up. With respect to separate causes of action and negligence, that's in the comments. That's not.
It's also in the statute. It's the last provision in the statute.
No. That's my point, Your Honor. It's in the comments to the third restatement, and in this statute. The legislature chose to expressly say that this statute does not apply to negligence cases. So there, the legislature expressly told you, don't use that comment. But with respect to 1A, they didn't say that. And it's clear their adoption was word for word.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you for oral argument in this very case. We'll reconvene.